Silence!
Oppenheimer!
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
This is Nerd Prey Radio!
Nerd alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 70 of Nerd Pride Radio. 70, the length of copyright in years after an author's death. As I researched that topic, by the way, I noted that France, where copyright is also lifetime plus 70 years, there was an asterisk after it, indicating that there's some sort of exception for written, non-musical works by persons who died for France. I don't know what that means, but that is fascinating, isn't it? Anyway, ask me how I'm doing today. Go on. Ask me. I am awesome. My name is Mike Jones. I am a D&D / Pathfinder nerd, a history nerd, a sci-fi nerd, a comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, comedy nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd. Plus, there's like 7 other kinds of nerd I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You're listening to Nerd Pride Radio, the place I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff that just won't fit in my head anymore. My co-host this week, the Virgin Connie Swale. All right, let's get right into the meticulously plotted portion of the podcast. This is the time for me when I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. If something strikes me as interesting during the course of my busy, busy week, I add it to my master list. And the best stuff off that list gets spewed out all over you guys every week when I record. You lucky dogs. So, straight into it first. That's right, it's time for a little feedback. And actually, I should explain that this particular feedback will also be yet another installment in our all-too-frequent segment, Mike Was Wrong. And apparently, you're going to have to get the little ones out of the room and make sure you're sitting down for this because...
Nerd rage came flashing back, and I just looked at him and went... Rrr!
That's right, it's time for Sarah Beth's Nerd Rage. Yeah, I've taken a feedback, and a Mike Was Wrong, and some Nerd Rage, and I've rolled them all up into one segment because, well, that's what's happening this week. So, I got a note from Sarah Beth, who is apparently 3 episodes away from having listened to the entire library of Nerd Pride Radio, which means that by the time I release this, I'm betting she's done. And she writes to me, and she says, among other things, quote, "Okay, Mike, here's my nerd rage for you. This is brought to you by Hug a Ginger Day and that episode of the podcast where you called us gingers." See, I don't like where this is going already. She says, "Please stop calling us gingers, especially for a man who claims to have a thing for redheads. Pretty please stop calling us a derogatory term. Ginger is beige, and my hair is red. Trust me, my temper might be slow to build, but it is hotter than the hottest piece of ginger you'll ever eat, so it doesn't even make sense. Parenthetically, I also happen to have a soul, thank you very much, Matt Stone and Trey Parker. You may kiss the fattest part of my ass," except she spells it arse because I think she's British. She continues, "Also, do we really need yet another term to separate people based on a physical feature? I mean, shouldn't we focus on what makes us the same and beautiful inside, not something that makes us different on the outside? I truly love my hair and consider it my best physical feature, but I was sure as heck bullied a lot for it as a kid, and that sucked. I actually hate when people are overly all PC about stuff, but I don't think we need to use something that is specifically designed to be pejorative either. I love that nerd / geek, etc. are losing their negative stigma, but frankly, ginger hasn't reached that point, and I don't see it happening anytime soon. Let me preface this by saying..." Now I'm getting into my part. This is where I wrote out an entire response. I put a lot of thought into this one. So that was hers. I have a written response that I'm going to read and kind of ad-lib through. Where we say that... nerd and geek have lost their negative stigma. Did I tell you guys last week? I can't remember. That I saw a quote from Fonzie from Happy Days in their big episode on racism. their big episode on racism in Happy Days was summed up at the end by everyone learning a valuable lesson and Fonzie telling the audience that, yeah, that's right, racism is for nerds. See, that was a show about the 50s, but that was made in the 70s, and now 40 years later, we're past that, like, clearly. I mean, it has a lot of commentary, but that's not what I'm here for. I'm detracting from Sarah Beth's point, so I'm just going to leave that lie, and you guys can draw whatever you want from that. Let me get into my response to her. Let me preface this by saying you are absolutely right, Sarah Beth. Absolutely. I apologize without any qualification. I was wrong. You are absolutely correct, and I'm very, very sorry for having done that. And, okay, maybe one qualification. You're way back in the episodes now. How far back did I do that? I've evolved a lot in the last few years. I really have. You gotta know. I mean, some of my best friends are gingers. Okay, see, that's not helping me. This is one where, as I said in my personal response to you, that was something where I was being an insensitive asshole, not even realizing I was being an asshole, and I was doing it all under the guise of the idea of, hey, come on, everyone knows it's just a joke, I'm doing it ironically, come on, it's funny, right? Okay, but really, it's not really all that funny. And essentially, for me at least, every time I make a soulless ginger joke, really, all I'm saying is, hey, remember that funny episode of South Park? But see, here's the thing. Matt and Trey, as much as they can kiss the fattest part of your ass, and they make big statements, all right? They have a point to make with their humor. And even though I don't always agree with them, and I really don't, I respect what they're trying to say, at least, or that they're trying to make a point. I mean, for example, with the Soulless Ginger episode, or what was the one? The disaster episode. Was it the flood one? I can't remember. Where Cartman keeps coming after Kyle to get his Jew gold. All right, they spend the entire episode, both of these episodes and others that they've done, they spend the entire episode pointing out that racism is really stupid. All right, judging people based on physical appearance is really, really stupid. They make this point all the way through it, that stereotypes are completely nonsensical, etc., etc. That's their point, is that racism is dumb. Stereotypes and prejudice are stupid. But they always end it with the twist of, yeah, okay, but wouldn't it be funny if we made that whole statement and at the end it turns out that the stereotypes are actually real? Wouldn't that be funny? Kyle really did have Jew gold. How about that? Turns out gingers really don't have a soul. Okay, and that's the humor. That's the surprise ending that puts a twist on it. That's their style. The problem is after they get done with it, there's douchebags like me who found the episode funny, and then I walk away from it forgetting about passing along the whole prejudice is bad message because I just assume that that's taken for granted, sure. And the only thing I remember is, hey, making fun of redheads is funny. Let's do this. So when you take it out of context like I did, it's actually just kind of mean, as you have pointed out to me. And actually, technically, it's also mean in context. I get that too. But, you know, there's allowances for people who are making a point. That may not be the style that I choose to make my points now, but okay, I get where they're coming from. But I guess what I'm saying here, and I'm not saying that anyone else needs to stop making these jokes, all right, that's entirely on them. You make your own judgment on what language you're going to use and how you're going to present yourself to people, even if you want to be a horrible, awful bigot. You could do that. That's your choice. What I'm saying is I am going to try and stop making those jokes, all right? I'm going to try and stop making jokes that are based solely on physical appearance. Look, I've tried to stop using gay references as insults, using female references as insults. And that was not an easy thing to do, all right? The getting rid of the gay references was actually pretty easy. Once you recognize that calling people gay, calling people fag as an insult, once you realize that that's really not a good thing to be doing, that one's actually kind of easy to stop. You just stop using the words gay and fag. And then once I stopped using gay and fag, then well, fag I hadn't used in years. But once I stopped using those terms, my kids followed suit and they realized that, yeah, you know what, that's not good. Even though they're teenagers and all their friends talk like that, they realized, yeah, you know what, that's not cool. Let's stop doing that. But then would still use terms like, okay, effeminate, which means the exact same thing, but we're just not saying gay. And I'm like, nah, dudes, you're not any better doing that. So, but stopping using female terms as an insult, you know, I mean, okay, it's easy to say, okay, throws like a girl. That's, that's an easy one. But there's so many things in English, just in our modern culture, that imply that being like a girl or like a woman is a bad thing. And being like a man, because that's the other thing, is the opposite. When you tell someone, oh, come on, be a man, grow some balls, man up, that what you're implying is that if you are not like them, if you're not like male, if you're not male, if you're the opposite side of that on the gender scale would be female, if you're not male, then that's a negative thing. And those are, that's really hard because that's really, really pervasive. Okay, I've gone a little far afield from my apology. This is still a sincere apology. I'm going to try and stop specifically picking on redheads. The soulless ginger joke, while it may have been funny to me at one point, I get it. You're right. Hurtful and mean, and I'm sorry I did it. I will try and be better about that. But other things like that as well, and I wish I had written down some good examples of that because I'd start listing them off. Other people will point them out to me. But I mean, I don't find ironic racism funny. There's lots of comedians out there who make really horribly racist jokes, and they do it for the shock value because, well, we all know racism is wrong, and so therefore when we say something that's super, super racist, it's funny because we know it's wrong and we know we're not supposed to say it, and that's what makes it funny. That's ironic racism. And I don't find ironic racism funny. I really don't. I don't find ironic homophobia funny. I don't find the ironic sexism funny. I don't – so why in this particular case would I find it funny to ironically bash this other group, redheads in this case, for some – purely physical quality, as Sarah Beth points out, that they're born with. And okay, you know, you say you have no control over it. Obviously, people can change their hair color, whatever. But that's not the point. The point is, it's a physical trait that someone was born with. And why do you mock someone for that? I mean, you're gonna mock, I'm trying to think of the proper term. Damn it. I wanted to say dwarf, but little people. I mean, you're gonna mock someone for being short because they're short. And you know what? That's something that people do all the time. I know many people and have known many people who are dwarves, have various types of dwarfism or just little people in general. And everyone around them all the time thinks it's okay to just make short jokes constantly because, hey, well, they're short and it's, you know, we all know it's no big deal. It's, but they make fun of it and work it into the joke constantly. That has got to hurt. And they all play it off like it doesn't. And for some of them, maybe it doesn't, but, I'm thinking, no, that's probably kind of mean too. So anyway, I did have a point and I think I made it and I'm sorry. You're absolutely right. I was wrong. And now we'll move on. And I understand that you're pointing this out to me and this is not like we're in a huge fight or anything because you're a cool person and I get all that, but I did want to acknowledge that you have a point. So thank you. Now escaping from that, updates. I can't even do the voice. I was in such a hurry. Updates. God, something's wrong with my voice today. I can't do the updates voice. Anyway, updates. I am at 250 pounds as of this morning. So that is progress. I don't know if that's, I lost a pound from last week or two, or I have no idea what the actual loss is, but I do know the number 250. I'm just about to cross into the 240s. And while, you know, a pound is a pound, you know, you lose a couple pounds a week, you're making great progress, but somehow the couple pounds a week that will push me down to 249, so that's momentous. So getting down to 250, it's a step. It's a huge, it feels like a milestone, so I feel good about that. But also under updates, really quick, we're still doing Deadpool coming up, so if you're interested in signing up for the Deadpool, get on it. Start thinking about your list, putting it together. Again, you've got till Christmas Eve to turn it in, but don't wait till the last minute. You won't be happy with it. Just be thinking about it. You don't have to write anything down yet. Just think about it. And Hero Battle is going amazingly well. I'm just going to tell you, Hero Battle's going amazingly well. That's it. We're having a lot of fun. It's great. And I tell you that so that if you want to get excited about Hero Battle, when this one's over, we'll probably have another one pretty quick after this. I mean, again, our usual pattern has been do two or three in a row, and then we take a break for a while. So be looking for it. If you would like to join the site, or if you'd like to join Hero Battle and you're already part of the site, just look for it. We'll be putting up a new thread for it probably in about 2 weeks, is my guess, is when we'll be getting ready to start the next one. So I'll keep warning you guys as we go. Enough of the updates. It's time to visit my gaming table. I've got Dungeon Master's Guide. Role-playing role-playing games, video games, card games, if it fits on my gaming table, I am here to share with you. I have multiple things. One, our Rune Lords campaign and my awesome character Dothan, whom I love and is now at fifth level. We just hit our one-year gameiversary. Thank you, Sarah Beth, for the term. I appreciate that. We have been playing this game for just over a year, and it's super exciting, and I'm loving this game. We just played last night. Last night was kind of a slow one. We didn't have everybody there. We were slow to get things together. Darks was a little unprepared, which is weird, because in the last year of doing this, he's never been unprepared. So, all right, we'll cut him a little slack this time. Had a great time, but we didn't get as far as we would have hoped, so we'll pick up in 2 weeks. It'll be fine. But I also played some Pathfinder with my kids this last weekend, and it was, I mean, we play fairly often, but this one was unusual because my 11-year-old, Eli, he has always said, oh, why can't we ever play a really long session? Why can't we ever play for like 8 hours like you used to do? Because he has this vision in his head, because he remembers when he was little, he was too young to play D&D, but his older brothers played, and they would have friends come over, and we would play these marathon sessions where we'd spend an entire Saturday gaming for 6, 7, 8 hours. And he has this vision in his head that we used to do that every weekend, which not the truth. You know, they were busy kids, and we had a tough time getting together. And we maybe all of, you know, 5 times got together for one of those really long marathon sessions. But in Eli's mind, it was always. It was always. And how come we don't do that now? And so I try and explain. But either way, we wound up this weekend playing a marathon session. Saturday, my wife went off with her mother and her sister, and they went to go see a show in Omaha. So they made a whole day of it, and they went out shopping, and they went to dinner, and they saw the show, and they had a great time, and they didn't get back till 1 in the morning, something like that. And as a result, we started right away in the morning, and I told the kids, hey, you get everything done you need to do, we'll game for as long as we've got. And so they did all their homework, and they read their books for school, and they got their chores done, and they washed the dishes, and they took care of the dogs, and cleaned the guinea pig cages, and they got everything finished. And then it was time to game, and we sat down to play Pathfinder, and we played, yeah, good solid 6, 7 hours. It was awesome. It was one of those adventures, because I wasn't – what I've been looking for is they have said they want a real adventure. They want a real – because, you know, up till now we've been kind of winging it and we're doing this and that. And there's some, you know, really cool plot things going on. But they want a specific direction where we want a certain goal and we're going to accomplish this goal. Enough of this wandering around, running away from stuff. We want something that we're going to do. And so I've been waiting for the stuff I bought on the Paizo Golem sale that the books are supposed to come in. And then I've got a couple of adventure paths in there and several standalone adventures. And so I wanted to find one of those that would work perfect. They're headed to the center of this forest. They have a clue that there's something there that they want, and we've kind of left it sort of vague. But when they get to the middle of this giant forest, whichever book is most appropriate, I'm going to drop it into that location, and we're going to make a huge thing out of it. But the books haven't come in yet. Oh, I'm so disappointed waiting. It's taking so long. So in the meantime, I went downstairs through all of my old dungeon magazines, and I found all the ones that had adventures for roughly, you know, 4th to 7th level or wherever it is that they're at, and flipped through them until I found one that was set in a forest, was fairly short. It's something they can do in a session or two, and then they'll be ready to move on to whatever the big book is that I get from Paizo. And I picked one that looked absolutely perfect. And it is a temple in the forest, and for whatever reason, either they seek it out or they run across it, but they wind up in this temple, and it's an old temple with this big long backstory, and the temple has an evil priest that has taken over, and the evil priest has this horrible ogre sidekick, and they've been terrorizing the pilgrims that come to visit, and when I say terrorizing, I mean, you know, killing and then feeding them to the ogre. And therefore, they have to clean this place up, dispatch it, and then it's pretty straightforward. And I look at the map, and I'm like, well, maybe this is a little too simple. I mean, honestly, you know, the story is, hey, you get to the temple, you have to dispatch these guys. And the temple is literally, there is a front entryway. You got the front porch, and then there's a front entryway. And then from the entryway, you go straight into the giant temple room, and then the temple room has one door in the back that goes to the priest's quarters. That's the whole map. I mean, literally, entryway, giant temple room with a huge tree in it, and then the priest's quarters at the back. There's no hidden passages. There's no secret dungeon. There's no nothing. That's it. It's one giant room with two little side rooms off of it. That's it. And the plan is for the bad guys, they have two pet dire weasels, which, okay, dire weasel. I did not realize dire weasels are 12 foot long. These things are gigantic. They're massive, and they have super bonuses to stealth, and they're really sneaky and really dangerous. When they bite and latch on, they don't let go. They bleed you dry and tear your throat out, and it's horrifying. So they got the two weasels, the one ogre that has some character levels, so he's about 7th level equivalent. The team is 4th level. And then the priest, who is also 7th level equivalent, the tiefling priest of nature, but evil. He's sort of the avenging spirit type who resents civilization and wants to drive others out of his forest, and he's kind of cruel and evil. And this is the whole thing. And so what happens is, when they show up, it's supposed to be the dire weasels are setting guard in the front entryway, and they're hiding, so as soon as they spot anybody, they go sneak off into the back. They warn everybody else, wake them up, warn everybody else, and then the four of them will all stand together, kind of hiding around the tree. And hold on just a second. Hold on. Ooh, sorry about that. And then the four of them make a stand against the team, but they've had time with the weasels warning. They've had some time to buff themselves. And so the bad guys will be really, really ready for this. And as a team, the four of them are really formidable. I mean, it's essentially four characters that together are equivalent to about a 5th or 6th level party, as opposed to my group, which is equivalent to a 4th level party, because that's what they are. Really tough to deal with if it's handled correctly. It turns out, and this is the part where they had a blast. They had so much fun doing this, because you ever had one of those games where everything just comes together? Seriously, I mean, I love it when a plan comes together. That's what this was. Everything went exactly right. And therefore, they wound up winning with almost no fight whatsoever. They mopped up this place, had everything taken care of in almost no time, and it was done. And because, well, they did it right. They sent their goblin in. The goblin has, you know, like a plus 20 to his stealth. He's just massive at it, and he has gloves that let him climb walls. So he went sneaking in on the ceiling through the doorway, and his stealth roll was phenomenal through the roof. The weasels didn't even notice him there. And he's looking down, even though they're hiding, he's pretty good on the perception, and he spots one of them, not the other. So, okay. He slowly waves in the others, and just when they're getting close enough where they should be, where the weasels should be able to hear him, that's when he drops down and stabs the weasel in the head, and he doesn't kill it at all, but he does wind up surprising it and starts the attack. And then everyone else moves in, and they dispatch this weasel in no time. Now, in the meantime, the other weasel sneaks in to go wake up the ogre and the tiefling and get things started, because I thought, okay, they've dispatched one weasel, but the others will still have time to get together. And so when the weasel slips through the doorway to go warn everybody, I want to see, okay, and yes, I can hear the dogs. I can clearly hear the dogs. I know you guys can too, but remember last week, and I felt kind of bad, so I'm afraid to say anything to them because I felt bad last week. So we're just going to put up with that noise. Sorry. All right, so the other weasel has now snuck inside, and so I give them perception checks to notice it, but it's a hiding weasel. Somehow, the sorcerer, he's a dumb half-orc. He never winds up doing anything well except his magic. He happens to roll a 20 on his spot check, his perception check. He rolls a 20. He notices the weasel, and so he says, "Guys, I think there was another weasel, and it just ran in there." And immediately, the rest of the team, they just start giving orders, like, "Quick, get in there now!" All of them go mobbing into the other room. So they get in there just behind the weasel. The weasel's just waking up the ogre. So the ogre wakes up to be facing them. The priest is still in the other room in his bed. So they wind up, you know, the four of them, well, actually five at this point, wind up ganging up on the ogre and taking him out in almost no time. I mean, he's panicking, and he's screaming out stuff that is clearly a warning to the guy in the other room, and he's trying to get himself out of here. And they wind up dispatching the ogre with almost no trouble because, yeah, when he would have had a whole team, yo, tough opponent. But all by himself, no, not a problem. Not a problem at all. And so they get him done. And now it's just the priest. And they go back in there and the priest tries to play off the, oh God, thank God you're here. Thank God you've saved me from that horrible, horrible ogre. But just looking at the layout of the place, you know it's a lie when he starts. I mean, we did a bluff check and all that, but the guy didn't pan out. And so they realized what was going on. They took him prisoner. Ultimately, he winds up trying to escape and they wind up killing him. But see, the priest, again, if he had had time to get all of his buff spells in place, awesome. He would have done great. But as it was, he just rolled out of bed. He's got an 11 armor class. He's got nothing prepared. He had no defense. He needs his buff spells and he needs an ogre in front of him. And without that, he's really, really vulnerable. And so again, because they played it right and they moved quick and they were thinking and planning, everything just came together perfectly. It was so, it's the kind of thing that if you've ever played Shadowrun, almost every mission of Shadowrun that I ever ran for my group wound up with, okay, it almost always involves some sort of infiltration. They have to break and enter, and once they get inside, they have to sneak around, find what they want, get out, and it always winds up going really, really, really well for a long time. We will play a long time of all this stealth and all this whatever, and then something will go wrong. Finally, a guard actually sounds the alarm. Something goes wrong, and it happened every single time. And when something went wrong, all hell broke loose. It was done. Immediately, when the alarm was sounded, that's when the troll would open up with his heavy machine gun and just start blowing everything away. Well, the minute he's got his gun out, well, no one can stop him from doing that. So, all right, we're all in it. And then they wind up just tearing the entire place down. I mean, everything gets destroyed. All the bad guys get killed. Everything is wiped out. And now we finally go, once everyone's dead, now we go find our stuff. And I always wondered why they kept sneaking in. Why do you keep doing that part when, obviously, look, if you just busted down the doors and started blasting, clearly you're going to win eventually by wiping out the whole building. I never occurred to me to come up with an adventure where they are punished for doing exactly that tactic. I should have. But they never went with that as their first option. They always tried sneaking, and it always turned into a huge blowout gun battle every time, except once. One time, they pulled off their stealth, and nothing ever went wrong. The entire mission, nothing went wrong. Beginning to end, they got in, they got the stuff they needed, they got back out. No one ever saw them. No one ever knew they were there. It was perfect. And so no combat whatsoever. I mean, they dispatched the guard dogs without making a noise. They were able to get in without being spotted. They disabled the security cameras. They did everything they were supposed to do. And the one time it worked was honestly one of the best games they ever played. They had more fun doing that than almost anything else. It was really, really cool. And so I guess that's why they kept trying that tactic, is because when it comes off, when a plan comes together, the end result doesn't look like that, like it was that much of a challenge. I mean, we did it all right. Oh, the planning was there, the forethought, the teamwork, everything worked, and a plan came together, and it worked. And so there's something magical about that. There wasn't a whole ton of, like I say, for this temple mission, there wasn't a whole ton of danger for them. I mean, again, they wound up handling things so well that at the end, my oldest said, so that really wasn't all that tough, was it? And so I explained to them. I laid the whole thing out. I said, well, here's what was supposed to happen. And like, oh yeah, that would have sucked. Oh my God. Oh wow, we got lucky. And I'm like, well, yeah, a little bit of luck. I mean, that one spot check on the weasel, that was very, very lucky. But other than that, it was a lot of good planning too. And it just, and again, for them, yeah, even though they came off of it feeling like maybe it was a little bit easy, they also had more fun than they've had in ages. I mean, we did 6 hours of this, and there was some build up to it. They had, a whole thing in town where they had some encounters and they learned the backstory of the temple itself. And then they had some other encounters where they learned about this horrible ogre terrorizing the woods. And it never occurred to them the two things were tied together. But ultimately they get to where they're going. They wound up hiring a ranger. That's their fifth. They hired a ranger and they made it to where they were going, and everything was beautiful. It was absolutely wonderful. So, I'm just thrilled. I'm just thrilled. It's just another facet of gaming that I completely forgot about. I forgot what it's like to have this sort of game, and it was really, really great. And oh, by the way, that ranger, the random encounters for this particular mission, it's supposed to be set in a forest, and we were in a forest. And so the random encounters for the mission included several different things that you could run into on your way to the temple, and one of them was centaurs. And I understand that centaurs are traditionally forest creatures in most of these fantasy settings, but I've never quite understood that because I've never pictured a horse as being a forest creature. Horses are open plains. You don't see them in the deep woods, and yet centaurs always are. And I didn't like that. So I thought, okay, now it would make more sense if it was a deer instead of a horse. And then I said, oh, hey, well, there's my answer. I'll just make them deer centaurs or elk centaurs is what I ultimately went with. And I'm like, well, or whatever the equivalent of that is. There's got to be a name for that. Sure enough, servitor is the official name that I found for deer and elk centaur type creatures. And I found some really cool pictures of servitors. And so I made that the random encounter that they came across. So it wasn't actually random. I picked the encounter I liked best and gave that to them. And the intent of the servitor encounters that the servitors are, I mean, it's very much, I'm just using the centaur descriptions and stats, really. But the idea was that they are a reclusive people who, you know, only a few rare individuals are willing to mix it up with the outside world, and otherwise they try and keep hidden, and they're very mistrusting and xenophobic. And so what was going to happen is they would run across this just a couple of servitors out hunting in the woods, tracking something, who knows what. And the whole intent was if things went poorly when they encountered them, it would turn into a battle. And if things went well, maybe they would get some really useful information about the ogre, because the ogre has been terrorizing the servitors as well. And so that was the whole object, was that it was either going to be a great fight or great negotiation, diplomacy stuff where they get a bunch of information out of it. And instead, the characters went a whole different way, and they went, oh my god, I think she's a ranger. So, you know what? We could get her to join us. We could, and ultimately, the centaurs were explaining how, no, we have to do this. We're hunting the ogre because there's a bounty out on its head, and yeah, we don't normally deal with the humans, but if we can bring in the head of the ogre, there's gold in it for us, and, you know, modern world, we need money. We really need money. And they're like, well, hey, we can fix that. We're on the same path. Tell you what, you join up with us. We'll make sure you get the money. We'll help you out. You'll get the cash. And so they wound up getting a ranger. And she was awesome. Wow. And her partner wound up bolting because he was untrusting. He was the one that was trying to start the fight in the first place. That was going to be the whole point, is that she's reluctant but can be negotiated with. He's the belligerent one who wants to just fight and get the hell out of here. And so ultimately they hired her, and she came along with them. And I don't know, I think we're going to make her a permanent part of the group because she was just fun. And they could use a ranger anyway. And they're just so happy. Just so – they call themselves the Blackscale Guild now. And they love being this badass group. And this is all – I went back and listened to episode 51. And in episode 51, I talked about this group as we were – sort of in the semi-beginning stages of this group and this particular campaign for my kids. And I talked about the stuff that they wanted and how they just want to be badasses and they just want to do this. And I even mentioned in that podcast, I mentioned that, oh yeah, Eli just really, really, really wants to play a marathon session. And all the things that I was talking about in episode 51 that my kids wanted and I wanted to make for them in this game, well, that's kind of what we got to. I mean, a lot of it's happened along the way, but a lot of it also happened just this weekend, and it was really good. Okay, I've babbled on enough about Pathfinder. I've really got to move on. I've got other things here and just not enough time. You know what? In fact, you know what? I'm going to do – I've got two more things. One of them is another gaming table item, but it's minor, and the other one is a little bit longer. I'm going to save the other one for next week. And this time, let's just do as long as we're on the gaming table – a question that came in for the Podomatic, and then later he wrote me back and said, yeah, but you know what? Actually, I just really kind of need to know this information. So rather than waiting, you know, maybe 2 weeks, maybe 5 years for it to show up on the Podomatic, I gave him an answer. And as I was typing it out, I thought, hey, well, this is something I'll share as long as I'm here. So the question is, in my opinion, what is the best Pathfinder /D&D class for new players. If you've got complete newbies, what class is going to work best for them? And I gave it a little bit of thought. And ultimately, there's two answers. One is, any class is good because you start off at first level, and first level is fairly simple, and therefore, whatever you pick, you're going to figure it out, and then you'll learn as you go. You know, by the time you get to second level, third level, fifth level, 12th level, once you get up to where it's really, really complicated, well, then you've figured out stuff as you went. As each new power comes up, you learn that power, and now you add that to your repertoire, and now it's time. Okay, but that's not a real answer. And the answer that I gave and that I like is, I think it depends on what you want to do, but I would go with what I consider to be the simpler classes to play and work with and understand. And that would be, for me, if you want to be a fighter type, I wouldn't go with fighter. Fighters have a lot of feat choices and a lot of the feat tree, the chain of feats to get to where you're going is actually pretty complex, and there are lots of ways you can do it and lots of ways you can optimize it. And I know that there's retraining and options for switching things out later, but with a fighter, especially if you're a new player or if your whole group is inexperienced, I would feel there's just too much chance of getting a fighter up to fifth or sixth level and going, oh, you know what I should have done? And now if you want to fix that, you've got to retrain four different feats to get to where you're going, and you have to – fighters are pretty complex, and which makes them really powerful, and I love fighters for all that. But honestly, if you want to be a fighter type, go barbarian. Barbarian, you have to learn the rage power and how it works, and otherwise you smash stuff. I mean, it's really, really fun, and they have enough skills and some variety that you can do some interesting stuff, but mostly barbarians – they wear light armor, and they carry huge two-handed weapons, and they smash things, and they're awesome that way. And you can, and obviously, there's lots of different ways to play a barbarian. There's lots of ways to play every class. But in its basest form, if you want to get in there and just start hacking away at stuff and doing massive damage and disabling things right out of the gate, barbarian is an awesome, awesome way to go. Lots of hit points, lots of strength, lots of damage, and they're great at what they do. So that would be my first recommendation. If you want to be a magic user, if you want to sling spells out there, personally, sorcerer. Sorcerer is a great starting class because the way magic works for a sorcerer is much more intuitive than the other ones. The whole idea of having spell slots that you pick or memorize spells, pray for spells, however you get them, that you have to select your spells every day to figure out what it is you're going to do, is fairly complex, and it's a lot of work. I mean, to be a wizard, you know, even just starting out, a wizard can have an awful lot of spells or can acquire an awful lot of spells really quickly. And then to only have a few each day, and so every day you have to pick which ones you want based on what your need is going to be in that particular, it can be a lot of work if you want to do that. Or druids or clerics are even worse because they have how many spells to choose from? They have all of them to choose from, and they get to pick every day which ones they're going to have. Rough. But sorcerer, look, you have a set spell list. Here's all the spells I can cast, and the ones of each level, I can cast them X number of times a day. That's all you need to know. Sorcerer is really straightforward. I mean, if you're going to have to learn magic, sorcerer is probably the fastest way to go. I didn't think of oracle. If you want to be a healer, you could go oracle to get the same kind of sorcerer effect, but on the divine/healer side. Oracle's pretty good at that, so I should have included that in my answer. But all the other spellcasters are a little more complex. And also, you know, look, wizard, druid are probably ultimately way more powerful than the sorcerer or the oracle or even the cleric. But again, they require a lot more work to learn and a lot more work to, like the fighter, to know what options are going to go together best to make you that really killer class. A little harder to do. So that's my recommendation. Or last of all, look, if you want to be sneaky, there's just the rogue. That's really, rogue is the only way to go. Bard is kind of in the rogue category, but Bard has to balance so many different things that they can do. It's a lot more bookkeeping. I mean, I personally think Bards are super easy. I think Bards are the simplest class, but that's because I've been playing a Bard for a year now, and I look at the damn Bard page at least 3 times a week as I'm analyzing my spells and my skills. I mean, I know Bard up and down, back and forth. So obviously, to me, it's going to look simple. To a new person, not so much. And I guess also with Rogue, I mean, if you want to go sneaky, you can also do the Ninja, there's other options, but it's not, just go Rogue. Just be a straight-up thief, and it, you know, for that one, look, you learn how your backstab works and you learn how the skill system works. And then you pick a lot of skills. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. I mean, so those would be my recommendations. If you're just starting out in D&D or just starting out in Pathfinder and you want a class that is easier to master in the beginning, yeah, start with one of those, Barbarian, Sorcerer, Rogue. Those are the three that are really going to get you by. But, you know, honestly, it doesn't take much experience to get a grasp on any one of the others. I mean, they're all viable options, but those would be the three that I would recommend personally. I mean, that's why, like I said, my youngest, my 8-year-old, wanted to have magic so bad, and he didn't care what kind of magic, he just needed magic. And I knew that having the option of having this spell book where he's going to have to pick out stuff would be way too much work. He's 8. He's never going to do that. He was 7 when we started this campaign. He wasn't going to do that. So I just made him a sorcerer. And then that way he can just look at the sheet and go, okay, there's the spells I have. And look, first level spells, I can cast 5 of those a day. Let's go. That's it. It's all he needs to know, and it's easy for him. I like having that laid out like that. So, you know, it was the choice I made for him because, yeah, he's 8. So anyway, that is my gaming table. We are all done with the meticulously plotted portion of this podcast. It is already 40 minutes into the podcast. So, holy crap, it's time for the Pod-O-Matic! Holy blueberries, this is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 and his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble, and he rolls up random topics for me to talk about. And where do these topics come from, you ask? Well, that is where you come in. You want to hear me haver on about something? You send your question or topic to me by email, or better yet, in a private message on our forums, and I will add it to my Pod-O-Matic list. Pod-O-Matic is about whatever you want it to be. And first up is number 11. Number 11 is from, it's from Mrs. Darks. Hey, Mrs. Darks. Mrs. Darks says, what is your favorite antiquated expression? And then whatever it is, should we bring it back? My brother and I actually worked on this for a while. And one of my favorites that we found was a pack of fives, which is an antiquated expression, an old-timey expression for a fist. So if you want to open up a pack of fives, you're wanting to lay on a knuckle sandwich or whatever. Give them a fat lip. You're going to – whatever old-timey expression you want to use. But open up a pack of fives as a reference for punching someone in the face, I just think that's really, really funny. Should I bring it back? No. No, of course not, because, well, you know, threatening to punch people is not as cool as it used to be. And so, therefore, I don't want to encourage us to start using that again, but I still think it's a great expression. Or any old-time prospector swearing. Again, also shouldn't bring it back because it sounds silly now. But from the old Bugs Bunny cartoons, for those of us who are old enough to remember when that was on every Saturday, and okay, back when Saturday morning cartoons were a thing, the old Bugs Bunny cartoons, anytime Yosemite Sam started going off with Consarnet was one of my favorites from him. Any of his swearing expressions, a lot of them were actually real old-timey swearing expressions, or, you know, substitutes for real swearing, but expressions that were common as, you know, darn it right now. And when I think about that, I heard an interview with someone involved in what was the name of that TV show? The old Western one. I never actually watched it. What was that one? Was it Deadwood? Or was that a movie? It was probably also a movie. I think it was Deadwood was the TV show. I never watched it. But anyway, in Deadwood, the characters, because it was on, you know, Showtime or HBO or whatever it was, they did a lot of swearing. And in fact, the word cocksucker was used quite a lot as an insult, even though what I saw was that was not actually a real insult at the time. I mean, it certainly could have been, but it wasn't a common insult back then. But the problem was, when they wanted to be authentic, they went and looked up, did research on what would have been authentic swearing at the time. And all of it, by modern standards, sounded so tame. And it sounded, whenever they wrote that dialogue, it sounded like Yosemite Sam swearing at Bugs Bunny in a children's cartoon. And it sounded so ludicrous that even though it may have been period authentic, they couldn't use it because no one would take that seriously. So they went with cocksucker instead. So anyway, pack of fives. That would be the one that I care about. There you go. Awesome. 32. And 32 is from, let's see. Oh, there it is. Oh, it's from Mrs. Darks again. Oh, the woman dominates. Mrs. Darks says, as we are a fairly newly minted family of four, we're working on making holiday traditions of our own. Other than cute pajamas, do you have any unique family holiday traditions that you are willing to share? See, why do you guys eliminate the good answer? Darn it. It's like you want to make this tough on me. Like you want to make me have to think. I'm not good at the thinking. It's hard on me. I am good at the stalling though until I can come up with a good answer. But other than the cute pajamas, if you've listened to an episode where I've mentioned the cute pajamas, then you've probably also heard this other tradition. It is all part of the cute pajamas tradition. Is that we always offer them the present ahead of time. They beg and they beg and they beg. Can we please open a present? We finally give in. Okay, Christmas Eve, you can open one present. Then they open the present on Christmas Eve, and it turns out it's themed pajamas for the whole family. And so that way we all have matching pajamas for Christmas morning. Okay, great. But that's the one I'm not allowed to talk about. Cute holiday traditions. I don't know. We used to make our own ornaments every year, but then we kind of... That's kind of hit or miss now. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. It depends on if we have a particularly cute idea. But, you know, see, my wife makes so many different ornaments at school, and the kids make so many ornaments at school that she's gotten kind of tired of them. We don't do Christmas cookies. We do, however, every year, I mean, one of the other gifts that they always get, one of the early ones every year, is they always get socks and underwear. I don't know if they've figured that out yet. There will always be at least one gift that they open up, and it's always from mom and dad. That's the big gift from mom and dad, is socks and underwear, because Santa brings all the really fancy stuff. But mom and dad give them socks and underwear. And also, mom and dad also give each of them a Woot shirt every year, which sometimes it's not Woot, sometimes it's from a cute t-shirt, something that's really appropriate to them and their interests at the time, but is also really funny and makes an awesome shirt. And it often they're from Woot, but they don't have to be. We do that every year. But what other cool holiday traditions do we have? I don't know. I mean, everything else we do just seems so normal that, you know, the decorating of the tree and the getting up Christmas morning, and the, fortunately for us, we don't go anywhere on Christmas. Oh, I love that. That's one of the things that we have, is that Christmas Day is just us at our house. We don't go anywhere. We don't invite anybody over. We don't do anything else other than we have Christmas with our family, and it's just us together. I guess rarely, sometimes, my wife's parents might come over for Christmas dinner later in the day. But usually they don't feel like coming out. They live out in the country, and usually there's some heavy snow, and they don't want to drive in. But everything else we do seems so normal. I mean, it's really the cute pajamas is the best. That was the winner. And by eliminating that, you're the one that made this question suck. I'm sorry. I tried. I'm just not getting it. If I come up with anything else, I'll come back to it. But that's about it. Nice. That is a 61. 61... I'm putting my money on Mrs. Dark. She seems to have a streak going. Let's see. Nope. Ronster. Hey, Ron. What? Ronster says, what is the worst smelling podcast on the internet? Okay. Look, I know he's popular. I know there's a lot going on. I mean, there's a reason this guy is as popular as he is. The man releases, you know, 12-18 podcasts a week, but Adam Carolla's podcast, clearly the worst smelling podcast on the internet, because Adam Carolla's podcast, honestly, smells like ham and whiskey and cheap hookers. I don't know why the ham, but it's there. It's noticeable. Listen to his podcast sometime. Clearly ham. 47. 47 is from... It's from Ronster again. All right. Ron says, what's the funniest one-liner you've ever heard? Oh, fudge. I can't tell you the funniest one-liner I've ever heard. I just can't. And actually, I'm just going to tease you with it. My very best, it's not even really a one-liner. It's a four-second joke. It has a little bit of give and take, but it's a four-second joke. But it is incredibly graphic and dirty in that 4 seconds. And I once called into Frank DeCaro's radio show and used it on him, and he laughed his ass off. It's really, really funny. I got it from my dad when I was in high school. And still, the best quick joke I know. But I'm not going to share it with you because it wouldn't be appropriate here. If I have to come up with the best one-liner other than that mini joke, probably something by Jack Handy. Deep thoughts by Jack Handy are hysterical, and technically, even when they're really long, they're technically one-liners. And I would say the one that always stands out in my mind, and I use this all the time, is whenever a child asks why it's raining, you say that's God crying. And when they ask why God would be crying, say, well, it's probably something you did. There you go. I love that joke, and I use that all the time. And for me, it's probably my presentation is terrible, so you guys may not appreciate that as much as I do, but I think that's really, really funny, and it's the kind of thing that I would enjoy doing to a kid. And, I mean, obviously, let them know you're joking afterwards, but it's a good thing. I'm sorry. Maybe I'm immature. All right, anyway, I shouldn't apologize for my sense of humor. I'm funny, damn it. 91 is from, if I could get to my list, there it is. Aha. 91 is from Ronster again. Ron says, if you could cure one specific disease for all time across all humanity, but it would cost the life of a loved one, would you do it? I don't know. If I were offered that choice, and I mean, if it were ironclad, and if they said, look, you could cure this disease, and you name whatever disease you want, you can cure this disease, you will save literally a million people over the next few years. You will save 20, 30, 100 million people over the course of history. You will save all of this human suffering, all of this, and all you have to do is sacrifice one of your sons. You know what? You will have this cure, but one of your sons will be dead. I mean, you're not going to make me kill him myself. Let's assume that it will just quietly die, and then the cure will magically be there. I think I would say no. That just seems wrong and unnatural. I mean, like I say, if it was some magical being that could offer me that, and I knew it was ironclad that yes, if I do exactly this, then exactly this will happen. That's tempting. If you had an absolute guarantee, which see in real life there are no guarantees, but if I had an absolute guarantee, it would be tempting. I mean, can you sacrifice one person to save millions? I don't think I can. I really don't think I can. I could sacrifice myself to save other people. I would have no problem with that. I don't think I could make that decision for another person. I just don't think I could do it. Man, that is rough. God, and I had another thought that went with it, but now for the life of me, I can't remember what it was. But, oh, damn it, what was I going to say? Oh, this is going to drive me crazy. Now I've completely lost it. Anyway, for me, it's a slippery slope. I mean, like I say, for me, the idea that if I had the absolute guarantee, I mean, I can see why that's tempting, but in real life, people make that kind of decision based on things that aren't guarantees, that they don't have some God descending from heaven that can lay these things out for them and go, okay, here's what's going to happen. And, you know, there's no sureties. This is people who are, in real life, people make decisions that, okay, look, this is going to harm somebody else, but the greater good will be worth it. So it's worth harming these other people in order to make this happen. And it's really dicey. And to me, it's really hard for me to justify intentionally causing a person harm, intentionally causing someone else harm who did, I mean, also in this hypothetical, we have to assume that whoever's being caused harm is not someone who, you know, in your estimation deserves it or whatever. We're talking someone who's completely innocent, who has no stake in this or has no contribution to it whatsoever. And that person will be harmed, or this group of people will be harmed as a result of what you're doing for a greater good. That's a tough thing for me to justify. I mean, again, yeah, when it's laid out in absolutes and it's all black and white, maybe that's a little easier to make a decision on. But I don't think I could do it simply because the slippery slope is there. I can't. No, I wouldn't. 74 is from Humongous. Hey, Humongous. Have you played Star Frontiers? Have I played Star Frontiers? If so, what was your favorite race? I mentioned last week Star Frontiers as a percentile system that I didn't care much for. But the setting was really cool. And again, this was another one that we had been playing D&D for so long. By the time we started playing Star Frontiers, I started playing it when I was maybe 14 is when I bought it. 15 is when we played our first game. No, it was before that. Anyway, it doesn't matter. 13, 14. Something like that. But we'd been playing a couple years worth of Dungeons & Dragons prior to Star Frontiers. And this was our first space setting that we got. And wound up, we never really had a whole ton of fun with it. It was a great setting. A super cool, awesome setting. Loved it. And would have liked to have done more with it. But I wasn't... This was before Star Trek The Next Generation. This was... You know, we had seen some Star Wars, but Star Frontiers isn't Star Wars. Star Frontiers is much more Star Trek than Star Wars in how it plays out. And so, therefore, I didn't really have the background knowledge of the right tone, you know, the right movies and TV and stuff that would have set this tone for me to make Star Frontiers into a really awesome, awesome story. I wasn't quite good enough to get it running. But great setting again. And for the races, absolute, hands down, top of line Dralocite. There's no question. I liked the Yazarians as well. Well, I liked all of them. The Brusks were cool too. But clearly Dralocites for me, it was Dralocite. Is, for those of you who've never played Star Frontiers, Star Frontiers is a space setting in which, if I remember correctly, you've got this, you know, whatever United Federation of Planets version of things that they have, and you're working for the official agency. I mean, it really was a Star Trek. It really was. And I didn't know that at the time. At the time, I thought, oh, cool space game. I never made the connection with, oh, this is their generic version of Star Trek. If we played it like Star Trek, this would be awesome. But we didn't do that. And the four main races that were involved in the Star Frontiers Union, whatever they called themselves, were humans. Dralocites, which were these 4-foot-tall blob creatures. They were like it's like a single-celled amoeba, but made, you know, made to be 180 pounds, and they could extend pseudopods off of them to form extra limbs or do other weird stuff. And they were kind of slow-moving, and they were short and stocky. They were the dwarves of Star Frontiers, and as such, appealed to me immensely. I loved them. I loved the shape-shifting nature of them, that ability to create the extra arms and legs, and they were very versatile, utilitarian kind of guys, and I liked that. It also included the Vrusks, and Vrusks were insectoid, centaur-like creatures that had 6 or 8 legs on their main body, and then they had the upper trunk, the centaur-like trunk that comes up to the arms and head up top. And then they had the Yazarians, which were essentially upright chimps that had flying squirrel-type glider wings on their bodies. And that was the four main ones. And the Dralocites, the blob guys, were clearly my favorites. Love those dudes. 83. And 83 is... I keep missing it. I am so bad at this game. Oh, it's Mrs. Darks again. Mrs. Darks says... Okay, it says, all right, I get it. I couldn't understand what she was saying here. Mrs. Stark says, I hear that train. Are you on the right or wrong side of the tracks? I am, oh man, I'm so close to the tracks that really I could be either side. I mean, they're right across the street from me. So I live here, and then across the street from me, running through the middle of what would be the house if they had houses on the other side, running right through the middle of where those houses should be, is train tracks. So, I mean, I'm practically right on them, but I'm trying to think of this town, and actually, the northern end of town is the better part of town, and then the southern part of town is the worse end. So if the tracks ran east-west, then, you know, it would be, you know, then that would be the dividing line. The north side would be the right side of the tracks, and the south side would be the wrong side of the tracks. Unfortunately, our tracks don't run east-west. They run exactly north-south. So therefore, they don't cut the town into a good and a bad half, stupid tracks. It's really kind of sad. God, it would be so easy if we could just say someone's from the wrong side of the tracks. That would be great, but we don't have that comparison in this town because our tracks don't run that way. Apparently, this was a lack of planning on the part of our founding fathers in this area. So I blame them. I mean, and also, and even when it comes to the north-south division, we're squarely in the middle of that. We sit at the center of town. I mean, our house is half a block off of the center of town. So even if they ran east-west, we would be technically on the wrong side of the tracks, but so close as to make no difference, really. 29's from, there it is. It's from Lucy. Oh, hey, Lucy. Lucy says, what dish are you best at cooking? Well, that depends on what you mean by best. I do what we call just bean stuff. It's a bean casserole that we throw together whenever we go to family gatherings. And it has got, it's, you know, baked beans and kidney beans and butter beans and a bunch of different beans in it, all out of cans. And then bacon and hamburger, and there's molasses and liquid smoke, and there's a bunch of other stuff, and sugar. And bean stuff is one that is probably the thing I am best at cooking simply because I'm really good at it. It's something that we've made it for family. We don't even make it for ourselves ever. We just make it when we need to go to a family dinner for a holiday or whatever. And I'm so good at making it that, you know, I know the ingredients off the top of my head. I know all the proportions off the top of my head. I don't even bother measure stuff out because I can just kind of toss it in the pot and make it go. It's easy. And I can do it really fast. And so I'm, you know, when you're talking about best as in the thing I'm most proficient at, I'm pretty good at that one. And I'm almost as good at making Eli's favorite potato soup, which is the official name of our potato soup recipe, which is also really good. And I've made it so many times that it's just simple to throw together. And in fact, just made some of that a couple weeks ago, put a bunch of it in the freezer. And I think I've only got one potato soup left up there. Love that. Really cheesy. Awesome potato soup. But the thing I like best of what I cook, I mean, again, it depends on what you mean by what am I best at cooking. The thing I like best is I do an Italian chicken recipe that I've probably mentioned before because I just really like it. And my Italian chicken, you do a breading, but the breading is made out of light Italian dressing and instant potato flakes. And so therefore, it's not a really high-calorie recipe. I mean, you get this really crispy, tasty seasoned breading, but without it being overly fattening. There's not a lot of grease in it. There's not a lot of, so, you know, if you buy some lean chicken to go in it, and then, you know, you roll it in the, you know, you dip it in your Italian dressing, you roll it in the potato flakes and the other spices and stuff that are mixed up with it, and then you bake it. And it's really tasty, and it's fairly low-calorie for being as good as it is. I really like that. That's our Italian chicken. But, I don't know. There's a lot of things I cook, but those are the ones, I mean, again, depends on your definition of best, but that'll be my answer for now. Last one, number 50. And number 50 comes from, it's Lucy again. All right. And Lucy says, how well do you think the average pet dog understands spoken human language? I do not think dogs understand spoken human language at all. I just don't. I don't believe that dogs understand human language in any way, shape, or form. Not any way, shape, or form, because obviously dogs do recognize specific command words. They can make the association of when I say this, it refers to this. But, sit, great. Stay, heal, awesome. But even with those, sometimes I think a lot of what goes into that is context. I think the dogs understand that when I have this inflection, when I have this body language, because they're very sensitive to that, when they see this from me, then they know what it is that I'm looking for them to do, and they respond really, really well to it. I don't think the spoken language part of it is a huge factor for most dogs. I think most people give way too much credit to their dogs for understanding language, when actually what they should be doing is giving their dogs credit for understanding people and understanding situations. I mean, dogs are really, really intuitive about a lot of that stuff, and they're really smart about sensing what's going on and knowing what it is that you want and then doing what it is that you want. And to misattribute that to the language because, oh yeah, as I do all of these things and I give these nonverbal cues constantly to my dog, as I'm doing that, I also am also constantly talking to my dog. I'm explaining what I want. And even though the dog's reading my gestures, to me it seems that, oh, clearly my dog understands me. Well, yeah, your dog understands your body language. Your dog doesn't necessarily understand your spoken language. That's my theory. I don't have a ton of science to back me up. But I'm saying that's what I think. This is, for example, horses that understand math. When you see those horses that know, you give a horse a problem, 5 + 2, and then it'll stamp out 7 times. Assuming that the horse, that it isn't just a trainer cheating, because there's lots of those, that the horses that can do math, it's just a trainer that's giving them cues. And it's really simple to do, but man, it looks really effective. But there have been a few horses where you give the trainer is taken out of the picture, and we ask the horse math questions without the trainer present, and they still perform. And oh my God, this horse does know math. They understand our language well enough, and they understand math concepts, and they go ahead and do it. But even those, what they discovered is that no, the horses don't understand what you're saying at all, and they don't understand math at all. What happens is if you give them a simple enough problem, then the entire audience knows what the right answer is. And the horse reads your body language. The horse knows that, okay, if it's been asked a question, it needs to start stamping its foot. And the whole audience is going to lean in and lean in and lean in. And then whenever I get to the right answer, everyone's going to relax and sit back. And so the horse knows that, okay, I just stamp my foot until everyone relaxes and sits back. Boom. I've given the right answer. The horse has no clue about math, has no clue about language. All they know is I stomp until they all back up a little bit. And then I stop, and then they all reward me. Awesome. And I think with dogs, it's a lot like that. I think they read body language. I think they know people. And they probably read a lot of things that we don't even realize we're giving off. And that's awesome for them. And again, this is not to say dogs are stupid. Give them all the credit in the world. Just don't go believing that they understand your language. That's all. So anyway, that is the end of this podcast. There is nothing left except for to turn to GLaDOS and get ourselves a recap. Go ahead.
Remember when the platform was sliding into the fire pit and I said goodbye, and you were like,
no way.
And then I was all, we pretended we were going to murder you.
That was great.
This podcast is copyright 2014 by Nerd Pride Radio. The opening and closing theme is Death Metal Disco by Ian Kronk. My bumper music this week was just Weezer's In the Garage at My Gaming Table. All the songs I use on this podcast are available on iTunes. Check them out, buy them, enjoy them. I wouldn't include them in my podcast if I didn't love them. If you want to do something nice for this podcast, recommend it to a friend. If you enjoy it, then spread the word and let other people enjoy it. Word of mouth is everything to me. Pass it on. Spread the joy. Don't forget to check out the free games I have available on my free games page, Instant Game, Animal Ball, Melee, Sandbox Hill, 2/3 of a dozen others, all free, all the time. If you want to contact me, You can always email me at mike@nerdprideradio.com. I promise I will actually respond to you. Or you can find me on Twitter, where my handle is @nerdprideradio, or even check out my Facebook page at facebook.com/nerdprideradio. But to be totally honest, the very best way to get a hold of me is to come sign up for my forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums. You sign up there, send me a private message, post in the threads, hang out with me. We will become best friends in the world. We'll have fun. And now it's time for Listener Betrayal. This is the segment of the show where I go to my forums and I see whatever people have commented on while I've been talking to you. Right as I start, I post up a thread that says I'm recording. And if anyone wants to add anything to this podcast, that's where they put it. So I posted up, got anything to add to the show? And the only response I have, hold on, let me close the thread down. Post reply. I should announce the buttons as I click on them. Done. And as I type, the blow-by-blow here is amazing. You guys really are getting the full experience with this. All right, anyway, the only response I got was, again, from my brother. My brother says, are you looking for a fun podcast to listen to in between episodes of Nerd Pride Radio? Then go to iTunes or whatever software you use and search for Me Like Trivia. You'll thank me later. Oh, dude, you are so right on with that. Me Like Trivia. Seriously, go listen. And then listen to Serial. For real, dude. Serial is an episodic dissection of a murder and trial over an entire season. It's done by the same NPR people that do This American Life. NPR meaning National Public Radio. I know you're used to coming to Nerd Pride Radio, but there's also another NPR, an upstart company, if you will, National Public Radio. And one of their most fascinating shows is This American Life. So, Serial is apparently done by the same people that do This American Life. Back to Kyle's commentary. It is simply amazing. I know it doesn't sound like something you're into, but listen to the first episode, then catch up. They're currently on episode 9. It is so good. So good. That's what my brother says. And he is a pretty smart dude, and he and I usually have similar tastes. So take his word for it. I am going to go load Serial into my Kindle right this moment. And also, if you find a podcast you like, even if you don't use iTunes to listen to that podcast, go to iTunes if you've got iTunes and subscribe to the podcast anyway, even if that's not the software you use for listening, because subscribing to it on iTunes counts more for their iTunes rankings than does good reviews or download numbers. The subscriptions in iTunes count for a heavy weight for them. So do that as a favor to any podcast that you happen to really like. Other than that, the next comment is me saying, hey, we're done here. Say goodnight, R2.